You know what philosophers must be. Because someone has said so, and perhaps also on the basis of argument. And
just doesn't think it on the point of guerre.
Hardly thinks. He learns to think. Thinking is an art he acquires, like all the others.
Well, oh, Mr. Butterworth, you looked at me. You are not sure that I'm right?
I didn't understand what he said.
I see, but doesn't hardly think it. Hardly? Not at all, it's too strong?
Yeah, he's
saying
Nipal's point.
Thank you. Good, so I apologize to our master. Yeah, good. Yeah. But seldom is surely not a.
Question part.
Oh, I see.
The question of the store of ability, the notion of art.
Mr. Rankin is blameworthy for that. I agree with that. Because Protagoras himself is responsible for this ambiguity. But what is at the bottom of it? I mean, how, with what right does anyone, Protagoras or Socrates or whoever it may be, makes this easy transition from ordinary decency to the political art? It is not merely accidental or due to some corruption of the sophistic mind. Yes.
Because the political art has to do with foreign relations as well as internal justice that it requires.
Yeah, but how is it? In other words, the statesman. A statesman is supposed to make the citizens better in the sense of ordinary decency, i.e. he must have ordinary decency to a much higher degree insofar as he can communicate it to the whole community what the ordinary man of ordinary decency cannot do. Something of this kind of matter. Do you want to say something?
Well, I mean, if he's in the political arena, he also has to deal with things which can't be handled as easily according to the rules of a private man, and hence would have to know how the rules of ordinary decency are best followed in a situation which involves toughness of one sort or the other, which the ordinary man would run into. So
That would also mean that he is better at ordinary decency than the ordinary decent man is, yeah?
Yeah, but he might in fact have to do things which don't work.
Yeah, no, that is, of course, all excluded from at this stage of the argument. Yeah, that is a longer question which will play a great role later on. Yes, now we have seen then that the authority of the city of Athens disallows Protagoras' claim. But the authority of the city of Athens, or of any city, is not necessarily the highest authority. Therefore, let us go on.
And not only is this true of the city, but of individuals. The best and wisest of our citizens are unable to impart their political wisdom to others.
So that is correct. Are not able to impart that virtue. That is translated as more literal.
That virtue to others. As, for example, Pericles, the father of these young men, who gave them excellent instruction in all that could be learned from masters. In his own department of politics, he neither
in which he himself was wise. He does not mention politics here, as though it is implied, but it's important that it's not mentioned.
That in which he himself was wise.
Is wise.
He neither taught them nor gave
teaches
them.
Teaches them.
Teaches.
Yeah, and he neither educates them himself nor hands them over to somebody else.
Nor gives them teachers. But they are allowed to wander at their own free will in a sort of hope that they would light upon virtue of their own accord.
Yes. So, you see, he calls now wisdom of what he called previously virtue. He changed that. Virtue is wisdom, is somehow implied here. We see here, incidentally, we get some of the first glimpse regarding the dramatic date of the dialogue prior to Pericles' death, obviously, because Pericles is spoken of in the present tense. Pericles died 429, but the dialogue generally is prior to the Peloponnesian War. Socrates was still in his late 40s, relatively young. Good. Now, Pericles is the authority, as you will see from the sequel. Yes?
Or take another example. There was Clinias, the younger brother of our friend Alcibiades.
Now, again, of Alcibiades, of this here Alcibiades. No.
Of Alcibiades here. Of whom this very same Pericles was the guardian. And he, being in fact under the apprehension that Clinias would be corrupted by Alcibiades...
Would of course be corrupted by Alcibiades.
Would of course be corrupted by Alcibiades, took him away and placed him in the house of Arephron to be educated. But before 6 months had elapsed, Arephron sent him back, not knowing what to do with him. And I could mention numberless other instances of persons who were good themselves and never yet made anyone else good, whether a member of their family or a stranger.
Now, Pericles is the authority regarding private things, as it seems from political matters. Protagoras was an acquaintance of Pericles. On Pericles' instigation, Protagoras became a legislator of a newly founded colony, whose regime was patterned after that of Athens. This we do not know from Plato, but from a later author. Alcibiades, Socrates' favorite Alcibiades, you see here, is a notorious corruptor. See, yeah. Perhaps a worse one than the Sophists, since we do not yet know enough about that. Alcibiades himself speaks in the dialogue called First Alcibiades of Clinias as a madman, and the two sons of Pericles as two fools. So, so the main point here is, virtue is not teachable. Neither the polis assumes that, nor the best men in the polis assume that. Yes.
Now I, Protagoras, having these examples before me, I'm inclined to think that virtue cannot be taught.
You see, again, the transition. Now, it's perfectly clear, virtue in general, without any specification. Yeah?
But then again, when I listen to your words, I waver and am disposed to think that there must be something in what you say, because I believe that you have great experience and learning and invention.
But that you have experience in many things, have learned many things, and some things you have even invented yourself. That is the maximum what you can expect. Yes?
Some things have even invented. And I wish that you would, if possible, show me a little more clearly that virtue can be taught. Will you be so good?
Here the word virtue in Greek arete is even used with a with the article, still make it more specific, that the virtue is not a teachable. This is now the question, of course, the question which was brought up before, originally he spoke simply of a well-advisedness. And how do we come from well-advisedness to virtue? By virtue we think, of course, of primarily of what Aristotle later on called moral virtue. How can we understand that? Well, as Aristotle himself teaches us, no moral virtue without prudence. But if moral virtue is to be teachable, as Protagoras presupposed the matter, of course, it must be identical with the intellectual ingredient of moral virtue, i.e., virtue must be practical wisdom, or generally stated, virtue must be wisdom, virtue must be knowledge. That is implied. When Socrates states virtue is knowledge, epistemic, and then he brings, he formulates in a way what the sophists imply. There are differences, as we shall see later. Repeat Protagoras' claim implies that virtue equal to practical wisdom, equal to science, techne, whatever you might call it. That is there, and we must later on see what happens to that. And in a way, that is of course the Socratic equation. But Socrates understands it differently than the sophists do. And that is the theme of this dialogue. Yes?
Sir, did you say practical wisdom or science or technique?
Well, Abby, you know, in the ordinary usage of this period, the distinction is not so clear. You can speak of technique, you can speak of episteme. The strict definition which Aristotle gives in the Ethics, especially, cannot be always presupposed. But here we have seen Protagoras calling the mathematical sciences technai. There is nothing wrong with that. Yeah. So, but there is surely a great difference between Socrates and Protagoras in this respect. This will become gradually clear, but we cannot yet know precisely what the difference is. Someone else raised his hand. Mr. Dryer.
Do you think that this claim of the sophists, which more than what the rhetorician made, has something to do with, as an explanation, to why the sophist is held in ill repute in a way that the orator isn't? I'm thinking of Hippocrates' blush and the eunuch's feeling. Somehow, this is so counter to the democratic feeling.
No, the democratic feeling would not be authoritative for a young boy like Hippocrates from the age. No, as that would not be okay. But the point is that a sophist is a man mostly coming from a relatively small town, yeah, not comparable to Athens, a stranger, and earning money by services, personal services. That's not gentlemanly. That is much more the view of Hippocrates.
What about Gorgias? Did he not need to earn money? Weren't people that went to learn with him?
Yeah, but that what he claimed to teach, the art of public speak, was so manifestly politically important. You know, this has to do with both the difference and the non-difference of rhetoric and sophistry. And in the Gorgias, the difference between the two is strongly emphasized. Here it is vague. Hitherto we do not yet see a clear difference. That will come out later. Yes?
In this passage, doesn't Socrates be ground on which a tyrant could well answer, well justify his tyranny? He says that the Athenian said that virtue is that the arts aren't widely known, such as medicine. And therefore the non-initiated can't judge the initiated. But we know that Socrates believed that that most people are non-initiated in the political art too, and that's why democracy is corrupt.
Sure.
Well then couldn't a man who wanted to be a tyrant say, in the guise of say a Lincoln, say a Napoleon, say, well, I happen to be an expert in the political art, as a doctor is in the medical art, and you aren't, so you can't judge my actions.
Yep, but since the tyrant is supposed to be a very unjust man, the tyrant could not possibly say it, but the king could. And so Socrates therefore doesn't hesitate to speak of the royal art.
But how could the people, many, counter the claim of the tyrant on the basis of what Socrates has said?
Oh, well, because the tyrant is supposed to be an absolute ignoramus and in addition wicked. That's simple.
But isn't it possible that a good man could seem to be wicked and open?
Yeah, that leads to a deeper stratum into which we cannot enter in this advanced stage of our study. For the time being, but that the kingly art is the highest art is said by Socrates often enough. And that the kingly art is by definition an art to be practiced in a monarchy, not in a democracy. Sure, that's a great question. Yes, now let us continue where we left off.
That I will, Socrates, and gladly. But what would you like? Shall I, as an elder, tell you, as younger men, a myth? Or shall I argue out the question?
Or shall I go through a logos, by a logos? Mythos and logos are used here as opposites. Yes?
To this, several of the company answered that he should choose for himself. Well then, he said, I think that the myth will be more interesting.
More gracious, more graceful. Yeah. Now we have here another case of the choice, no longer now between public or private, but between myth and, let us say, a rational account. Since it is a choice, it is another test of Protagoras' ability to give himself good advice, to make good or bad choices. Now this time the choice is proposed by Protagoras himself, but not by Socrates, as it was in the first case. Again, Protagoras is asked, at least by many, to make the choice himself, as you see. And he chooses to tell a myth. We are not told whether some of them didn't say rather a myth. And so that he complied with it. This we do not know. Now, we can say, it is reason to say that myth-telling is perhaps another of these cautions, these precautionary measures to which Protagoras referred in his speech about the difference between him and the sophists of olden times. In other words, that myth-telling belongs to the qualified character of Protagoras' candor. If this is so, is it prudent to emphasize that he tells a myth? Why does he not simply tell it without making a choice of it? And why does he not even call it a logos, a rational account? Socrates himself gives a famous myth at the end of the Gorgias, is recently called by him a logos. Someone wants to say something, Mr. Schuster?
Well, if he's made a more prudent choice this time than the last time, does this show any influence of Socrates?
And we must see. We must see. Before we are through the myth, we cannot judge of the myth. If I may say this, I believe the myth is not very good. I mean, it is in a way a wonderful thing from the point of view of language and so on, but whether it fulfills its function in the context, that I'm not so sure. Mr. Burke.
Is there this similarity between the two choices, that Protagoras first raises the question of a choice and then offers the decision to his interlocutor or interlocutors, and they offer it back to him?
Yes, but still, in the first place, he wouldn't have to offer them the choice in the first place. And in the second place, it is not excluded by the text that some said either a myth or a logos, because only many said. And so it remains. It is clearly, he emphasizes the fact that there is a choice and that he makes a choice, and therefore he is fully responsible for it. And we must see, we are compelled to see, to look out whether the choice was wise. Yes, and now the famous myth begins from here until 323a4. We shall not be able to finish the discussion of the myth today, but we can perhaps begin it. Unless you want to have a discussion of the point hitherto, and we take the myth here. As soon as we are through with the myth, I will, because it is for many of you, I suppose, the first time that you read a Platonic myth, we will have a digression on the Platonic myth. Yes?
Let me ask a previous question. That possibly Socrates is not fair in concluding the
political art can be taught. In the example that he gives, the fact that in the assembly, specialists are called upon in certain areas, but in another area, when politics in general is being discussed, anyone can stand up, no matter who they are. And as Socrates says, since these people aren't reproached, no matter who stands up, they aren't reproached. Socrates says that evidently the Athenians are under the impression that this sort of knowledge cannot be taught. Isn't there another conclusion that could be drawn that possibly this sort of knowledge has been taught to everyone? And therefore...
Yeah, all right. That could be, but then it would be... Still, then the question would not arise, who was your teacher? For example, say a man claims to have medical knowledge. And then you raise a question, if you have any doubt, show me your diploma. But if it is something which everyone is taught, say like reading and writing, you don't ask for it because you know that, and the test would be very simple. You would say, read this letter here. You know, it would be a test to speak of. That is in itself possible. But of course, well, how is it today? I mean, let's start from what we are more familiar with. Is there any, maybe that most senators and congressmen have studied law, but clearly, to be a lawyer and to be a politician are two very different things. In other words, law is very helpful for making political decisions, but it is not the same as making political decisions. Do we not still understand by political decisions which are not subject to, cannot be expert decisions, where only expert decisions can help? Take Vietnam or whatever you want. The experts can give you all kinds of things, and they will give you, in all interesting cases, there are invariably at least two schools of experts, as you know. And they don't help you very much. I mean, they give you some arguments against your political opponents. But ultimately, you have to make the decision itself. Is it not so?
Yes.
I mean, for example, this thing, Salt, how is it called, against infantile paralysis, expert question, never politically controversial that you should use it, never politically controversial, and other things of the same nature too, that there should be a proper defense force, it's not politically controversial. I mean, there are some people, some extremists, some marginal people who would say defense force, but that is politically irrelevant. All political question is by definition a controversial question which cannot be settled by experts. That still remains. And at all times there existed the hope that there should be some super experts, some master art, which would be do regarding the political matters medicine does with the human body, what shoemakers do with shoes, and so on and so on. But it is, to say the least, still an open question whether such an art exists. I believe take political science today, which is in a way the child of the politicae technae of which Socrates spoke, but it doesn't claim to be able to solve the political question. It only, the maximum it claims is to tell the political men which of their means are good for their ends. But it explicitly refuses to judge of the ends, as you know. Is it not true? So today we should very easily understand that although from an older point of view, from a pre-1900 point of view, this ground cannot be assumed. It was always understood that there is some knowledge, some science of the true ends of political society. Now, of course, a question would arise here because there is a variety of ends, and which end has priority in a given situation is not, this question is not settled by the general doctrine of ends and of their natural order, because the lower end may rightly demand first claim in a given situation. If I may use again my tried example, the appendectomy, something very low, may be more important in a given situation, more urgent than the highest human activities. The same applies the sheer defense of the country. I mean, a mere defense. All internal problems remain unsolved. Only the sheer defense. And maybe in a given situation, the overriding consideration. Yes?
What would Socrates' answer be to the situation when you have experts disagreeing? Let's say for bias, when you have experts on one side saying you have cancer, and then the expert on the other.
Read, there is a beautiful dialogue about that very subject, the Laches. It is not a medicine, a drug, which is there under discussion, but a certain form of fighting. And there are two experts. The one says it's bad, and the other says it's good. And so there is says, well, then we must have recourse to principles. What is the meaning of such combat training? Combat training, well, to make the men better soldiers, better fighters. This refers, belongs to the virtue of courage, manliness. Well, let's first find out what manliness is. And then they come into trouble there. And so much so that they do not answer the question of what manliness is, and which is in a way more interesting, they completely forget the practical question from which they start. But you know that this is a kind of comedy, because in practice, it's impossible, because in practice a decision must be made either without raising the profoundest question, and you have to adopt this piece of this kind of missile or that kind. You have to do something, and then it will be done with some tossing of coins, just as we do in private life. Don't you do that? Therefore, that's it. But nevertheless, the need, the desire for such a master technique is absolutely reasonable. I mean, plausible. Whether it can be fulfilled and to what extent it can be fulfilled is a question. The now prevailing view, to repeat, is that there cannot be such a master technique, because the question of the ends is not susceptible of rational discussion. That is now the prevailing view. Now, there may, even if this were untrue, even if there were a rational understanding of the ends and their order, this discussion might be so deep, so complicated, that it would be of no practical political use. This also could be. Well, I see the time is already tight. I conclude today a few minutes early, but I have to go to see someone here. And I will make up next time. And, yes, good. And I think we begin next time with the myth, and if we find the time, we will have a discussion of the platonic myth.
Solid statement?
Yeah, not quite, because he referenced back would seem to say that in this particular point he still agrees.
Yeah.
He still agrees, otherwise he wouldn't quote it. I mean, I think no one, there are people who think it is very necessary, if they change their mind, to indicate in every point, in my former writing I said this, and that is wrong, yeah, which one could take to be a kind of displaying oneself, yeah? And apparently Rousseau had this feeling too. So Rousseau, in quite a few points, changes the earlier view, and I think simply trusting the intelligence of the reader, who would not believe that the more primitive statement, the more elementary statement, can have the authority which of the more advanced statement. But precisely for this reason, when he refers here back to the second discourse, this would mean to say, in this point, I still agree with it. In other words, he does no longer agree with a simplistic statement about compassion occurring in the second discourse, but he agrees fundamentally with the teaching of the second discourse regarding jealousy, love, monogamy. That I would take. This is my interpretation.
But the reason I raised the question is my impression that the specific point about monogamous marriage in the second discourse, Rousseau had a different position from what he gives here.
Yes, but if he quotes it here,
yeah.
If he quotes the second discourse in this context, I would say he regards the statements in the second discourse, which are much more elaborate, still as substantially correct. And in other words, especially this long criticism of Locke in that note. Now, a few more passages, page 395, bottom.
Most of the habits you think you have instilled into children and young people are not really habits at all. They have only been acquired under compulsion, and being followed reluctantly, they will be cast off at the first opportunity. However long you remain in prison, you will never get a taste of prison life. So aversion is increased rather than diminished by habit. Not so with Emil. As a child, he only did what he could do willingly and with pleasure, and as a man, he will do the same, and the force of habit will only lend its help to the joys of freedom. An active life, bodily labor, exercise, movement, have become so essential to him that he could not relinquish them without suffering. Reducing all at once to a soft and sedentary life, and you condemn him to chains and imprisonment. You keep him in a condition of thraldom and constraint. He would suffer, no doubt, both in health and temper. He can scarcely breathe in the stuffy room. He requires open air, movement, fatigue. Even at Sophie's feet, he cannot help casting a glance at the country and longing to explore it in her company. Yet he remains if he must, but he is anxious and ill at ease. He seems to be struggling with himself. He remains because he is a captive. Yes, you will.
He is in chains. In the islands, literally. Yeah.
Yes, you will say. These are the necessities to which you have subjected him, a yoke which you have laid upon him. You speak truly. I have subjected him to the yoke of man.
Yeah, that is a very interesting statement, the complicated nature of freedom. So he, needless to say, that Emil likes to stay with Sophie, although the author doesn't say here, because you know this much, all of you, from at least from the literature, to know that this is the case. Good. In other words, there is a difference between being in chains gladly and not gladly. Now let us apply this to... in other words, even if it is true that men prefer civil society to the state of nature, this would be compatible with the fact that civil society is a state of chains. Would be compatible. But what does he say here about the infancy of Emil, where he did everything gladly and with pleasure? This is true, but is there not also something else true which we have heard about the education of Emil? It's the most general statement, at most...
Force and guile.
But yeah, he was kept there, guided by force and guile, of which he was to some extent, of the guile he was wholly unaware, and of the force he was not fully aware. So that goes together, that's a complicated thing, freedom. I believe that is very important.
Rousseau says that he has made him fit for every condition among men, but it's the one thing that a male cannot become. His tastes make it impossible for him to be an intellectual, let alone a philosopher.
Yeah, no, the intellectual level, that would not be decided from Rousseau's point of view. But the philosopher, yeah, but that is impossible for him. But I think one can say what Rousseau indicates here, man is always in chains. Always. I mean, only either the chains are gladly born, or they are not gladly born, but they are still chance. And the only freedom is this here, the sentiment of existence, where neither the future nor the past act as a frame, where a man is fully satisfied with the present. Yes?
Isn't it interesting, though, that the fullest development of the sentiment of existence in the fifth reverie also concludes on the thought where he says, I would be happy even in the donjon?
Yeah, because that is true freedom.
Because that in slavery there is wanting. Is that the
idea?
Because I am willing to accept being that.
Because in this is such, I mean, here Rousseau in a way returns to the Stoic teaching at this point.
Mm-hmm.
That it doesn't make any difference whether you are a slave or freeman, if you are a saint. Only Rousseau's wisdom is defined more in terms of the sentiment of existence than of insight. Yeah? More. The insight is also there, but the peculiarity is that. We need two more passages, I believe, on page 399, is the second paragraph.
Sometimes his steps are turned in the direction of the happy abode. He may hope to see Sophie without her knowing, to see her out walking without being seen. But Emile is always quite open in everything he does. He neither can nor would deceive. His delicacy is of that pleasing type in which pride rests on the foundation of a good conscience.
You know, that is not, we must not say so much. He has this, that amiable delicacy which flatters and nourishes the amour propre of the good testimony about oneself. You see, here we have clearly amour propre as a virtue or as a root of virtue again. Yeah, there is one more passage to which I would like to draw your attention. That is on page 404 in the fourth paragraph. Pardon? Is it? Well, all right, let us not be too strict. I mean, let us disregard these conventional sayings. Perhaps because next time we have many other things to discuss. Are you willing to read something which belongs to the next assignment?
Oh,
sir. Yeah, I thought so. I thought you might have accepted convention as a natural law.
That was all I said. But before anyone could speak, Emil, approaching Sophie, raised his voice and said with greater firmness than I expected, Sophie, my fate is in your hands. As you very well know. You may condemn me to die of grief, but do not hope to make me forget the rights of humanity. They are even more sacred in my eyes than your own rights. I will never renounce them for you.
And of course, this settles it completely. Yeah? I mean, that settles his fate completely in his favor. That there is something which, regarding which he will not make any concessions to Sophie. Now, it is only the word, the term, the rights of humanity, that is the rights of man. But here it has a slightly different meaning. Those rights, the rights of humanity in the sense also the rights which other have, the claims which others have on one on the grounds of humanity. But the phrase is still, I think, quite remarkable. I would say offhand, subject to revision, that this term occurs, comes up in the 18th century, just as the rights of man make their appearance there. Right. In other words, that the tendency to understand duty in terms of the rights which others have on oneself. All duty is social duty. Otherwise, this wouldn't make sense. I mean, and when later on people said there is all rights, all duties are correlative. Whatever there is right, there must be duty and vice versa. This is of course only true if all duties are social duties. Otherwise it wouldn't be true. Even under that condition it would not necessarily be true. For example, if someone has a duty of gratitude, that does not necessarily follow a right on the part of the individual to whom he owes gratitude to demand it from the other. But in the duties of justice in the narrower sense, this is certainly true, Mr. Selzer.
It's interesting that a meal, Sophie was first attracted to a meal when he wept at the plight of her family. In other words, expressed compassion.
Yeah, yeah.
And here again, when he expresses compassion towards the people that the man with the
broken
leg.
Yeah, poor people.
That he meets in the field, pregnant woman.
Oh yes, absolutely.
Again, compassion, and this is what decides her that she wants.
There is no question that this goes through.
This is what says, "Take my hand." Makes her say, "Take my hand. It's yours."
Yeah. No. Compassion is taken as an almost unmistakable sign of goodness. Goodness is understood as a feeling heart. That one can safely say is a very characteristic thing of the 18th century, especially of the second half. A good man is a compassionate man and vice versa. This was very powerful tendency there. And Burke has expressed it very neatly in the reflections on the Revolution of France, if I remember well. Or in a later writing about the French Revolution, that he distinguishes two kinds of virtues, these softer feelings and virtues, and the sterner virtues. Now the sterner virtues were pushed back in favor of these softer virtues. And the name was humanity, which if I remember well, in the Thomas's Summa, I do not know whether this goes back to older sources, humanity is defined as a virtue in the relation of man to people inferior to him. Yeah. I mean, for example, humanity cannot be, it's not a virtue regulating the relation between men and other men superior to him or equal to him. Now, for example, well, not in every respect, for example, there is a story. But humanity, for example, if a man may be very superior to you, but he may be sick, inferior. Now, in this, in the extreme form, the feelings for the underdog, the virtue regulating man's relation to the underdog, this became the preponderant feeling, and therefore all these reforms, prison reform and whatever else they began at the time, that all was, and this of course has remained a feature of Western thought. But it is also true that his pushing back of the sterner virtues has been retained by the same school of Western thought. There is a passage in Montesquieu, in the Spirit of Laws, in one of the books on commerce, I don't know in which of the two at the moment, but where he speaks of commerce, the old theme of Plato and Aristotle, that commerce corrupts the manners, intercourse with strangers, having other customs and all this kind of thing. And Montesquieu accepts that commerce does harm to the purity of manners. That he abstains, but he says on the other hand, commerce And since the very thing which makes for impurity of manners makes for gentleness of manners. This, I think, is a very beautiful formula. What happened is identical with Burke's diagnosis of what happened. And Rousseau plays here somewhat, and he's of course the prophet of compassion, humanity. And at the same time, the constant references to the heroes of Plutarch, the Spartan Roman ingredient. And it is so hard. It's one of the confusing things in Rousseau. Where does he really stand? Because truly, in Rome and Sparta, he wouldn't find this kind of thing. And yet he was, both things are in him. Someone raised his finger. I'm sorry.
I was thinking about the connection of this to conscience and whether the rights of man, or rather, whether the notion that that duties are derivative from the rights of man doesn't have to be modified somehow to bring in the primacy of conscience. That is, I had thought of duties being derivative first from conscience, which I know is connected with other men, but somehow, in other words, stemming from within, and not stemming from within primarily, and not stemming from the rights of others primarily.
I do not believe there is a direct connection between the two issues. It is so. I mean, that there is such a shift from duties to rights, I believe that can easily be shown. This is one thing. And the other thing is surely the conscience is much more frequently mentioned, say Rousseau, than it would be in an earlier age. Why? Not that the conscience was not known and spoken about, but if you take the Thomistic teaching, the Thomistic teaching, Thomas makes a distinction between the primary awareness of moral principles, which he calls synderesis, a word which has disappeared from using, and conscience. So conscience, we can say roughly, but you must correct me, by the way, the conscience is the application of what synderesis says to a particular case. Did I act rightly now, approving, disapproving, whatever it may be? Now the interesting thing is that this practical part of the whole, consisting of synderesis and conscience, becomes emancipated. Do you see? I mean, the conscience remains without the synderesis, but one could say, and therefore new theories of the conscience are required. So the practical meaning is that the conscience, as it is here used by Rousseau, means that all men, if they only would take the trouble, would not surrender to passions, would be as good judges of what is right and wrong, and one as good as any other. That I believe the vision. Whereas in the older view, there was always a great difference between children and old and mature people, and between wise and unwise people. When people speak of the conscience in the 18th century, this distinction is out. That I believe is a crucial. So there is a connection, I'm sure, between the two things, but they are not identical. The most extraordinary case which I remember is this, when Kant discusses in his Foundation of the Metaphysics of Morals a case, a father has received a deposit from someone else, and this man traveled to other continents probably, and when he comes back he has to give it. In the meantime, this family falls into misery, where the mother becomes very ill. I believe that's the point. And they need a doctor. They don't have money. And then the father is tempted to dip into that deposit. And Kant says, well, I'm speaking from memory, it may not be quite exact, but it amounts in substance to this. And Kant says that even a child of 10 years would know perfectly well that under no circumstances can this be done. In other words, that this case, a difficult case even for a grown-up person, would be decided by any sane girl of 10 years old. Now this is, well, Kant did not reproduce this statement in his more mature writings, but it is characteristic. The conscience does not require experience, if you take the Rousseauan statement. So there is of course it is not there in a baby in the cradle, but very soon after, that is an infallible guide and distinguished from reason. You have seen that Rousseau ordinarily uses conscience in contradistinction to reason, meaning the reasoning process, the considering of the circumstances, does not enter. This, I believe, is a point. In other words, remind you of the schema I gave in my last lecture. This has, I think, to do with the geometrization of the conscience, of natural right. You know, that you have, that it is, first of all, the geometrization means that the conclusions from the principles, however low, are equally universal as the principles themselves. Therefore you can treat natural law more geometrical. That's the first step. Now the second step is, in a way, in rebellion against this first step, you do not have to be a geometrician, a geometrician of ethics. You do not have to be a studier of the natural law, as Locke calls it. Everyone knows that, because we have in us something which gives us infallible guidance, and the trouble only is that we don't listen to it. We follow our passions without reflecting for a moment's reminder of our duty would be sufficient to give us perfect clarity, and not in such simple cases as should I steal money in order to buy drugs and other relatively simple cases, but in such a complicated case where it might really be defensible for that father to do what he has no reason about his friend will do when he is there, to take out some money for in order to save his life. And surely the child of 10 years would be completely unable to judge of that, because she would naturally say that the life of her mother is infinitely more valuable for the family. Think of all the implications which the death of a mother can have. And a little bit reflection shows possible, the impossible to use, which can't take that.
Well, in the view of Rousseau, does the conscience not only judge but also obligate one to a certain
end? Yeah, sure.
Well, then the duty.
Yeah, no, these are two different considerations. I mean, the consideration would be roughly this, especially considering the connection between duty as Rousseau understands and compassion. The simple natural feeling of compassion. Yeah? If you only remember it and do not follow your greed that you. Yeah, you take away from other to which you have a legal right, and have no feeling for the sufferings which you inflict. The simple compassion would already counteract the self-assertion. And needless to say, but I do not believe that
the teaching regarding the conscience which Rousseau uses throughout his work belongs from his own point of view to the center of his teaching, as you can see from the fact what he says in the first part of the fourth book. The compassion is not good enough. It must be generalized, as it was. Do you remember? This is, of course, no longer... if you see some poor fellow who is fettered and brought into jail, and you have compassion with him, and if you could, you would unfetter him and set him free. And you do not consider that he is a murderer and might commit any more murder. That is, the generalized compassion would of course say you have compassion and you exert compassion toward innocent people rather than toward criminals and so on and so on.
Would
mere compassion wouldn't be enough.
Would it be right to say then that you compassion is generalized because of your consideration of the rights of other men? In that sense,
yes, but this is a process. I mean, this is not compatible with conscience and this, as a sublime science of the simple soul. There are either one man is as good a judge as everybody else. This generalization is not a thing which everyone can do.
Your notion of the rights of man from generalizing
the compassion? That would not be true. The rights of man are derived from the fundamental right, the right of self-preservation, by a process of generalization. In other words, fundamentally the reasoning of Hobbes. So, we shall not meet Thursday because of Thanksgiving, but only next Tuesday that we'll be there.